The Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
A reading from the Holy Gospel according to Luke.
Glory to you, Lord.
When the time arrived for Elizabeth to have her child, she gave birth to a son. Her neighbors and relatives heard that the Lord had shown his great mercy toward her, and they rejoiced with her. When they came on the eighth day to circumcise the child, they were going to call him Zechariah after his father, but his mother said in reply, "No, he will be called John." But they answered her, "There is no one among your relatives who has this name." So they made signs, asking his father what he wished him to be called. He asked for a tablet and wrote, "John is his name," and all were amazed. Immediately his mouth was opened, his tongue freed, and he spoke blessing God. Then fear came upon all their neighbors, and although these matters were discussed throughout the hill country of Judea, all who heard these things took them to heart, saying, "What then will this child be? For surely the hand of the Lord was with him." The child grew and became strong in spirit, and he was in the desert until the day of his manifestation to Israel. The Gospel of the Lord.
I think that if many of my 7th and 8th grade religion students at St. Mary's School were asked to name the saint who is the transition figure between the Old Testament and the New Testament, between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant of Jesus Christ, that many of them would be able to name John the Baptist, whose birth we celebrate this morning. The feast of John's birth is actually important enough to eclipse the 12th Sunday in ordinary time. Actually, I was at Mass yesterday afternoon in Menominee, and I went from a wedding to the 4 o'clock Mass, and I put on green by mistake, and it was only in the middle of Mass that I realized I had the wrong color on, even though the whole Mass, in a certain sense, was focused on John the Baptist. But there's good reason for the importance of John and commemorating him in our Mass today. Our salvation, at least we can say that biblically, it does not begin with Jesus Christ. In a certain sense, certainly in the New Testament, it begins with John the Baptist. Although arguably one could certainly say our salvation or the beginning of our salvation goes back much further. Goes back to at least Moses. Many of us would probably say it really begins with Abraham, our father in faith. John is important not merely because he announced the coming of the Messiah. John's importance is framed in the context of God's providence, in God's unfolding plan to save the world, which again probably in Scripture begins with Abraham. The prophet Malachi predicted that a messenger, Elijah, or an Elijah-like figure, would prepare the way for the Lord, the Messiah. And Jesus clearly identifies John the Baptist as the fulfillment of that prophecy. Now, in our first reading, we heard from the prophet Isaiah, we're given part of Isaiah's servant songs. The Lord called me from birth, from my mother's womb, he gave me my name. Well, who is this prophet servant that Isaiah is speaking about? On the one hand, it can be understood to be Israel, the nation of Israel, through whom Isaiah prophesies that God will show his glory. So Israel is supposed to manifest the glory of God. On the other hand, the servant is a prophet sent to both restore Israel and to be a light to the nations, that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth. So God is calling this prophet servant to be a light, to be a beacon for God's universal redemption. And remember, that was then a responsibility first given to Israel. The image of a light to the nations has traditionally also been a favorite symbol for the church. So John is a bridge between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant, between the people of Israel and the church, which is in a certain sense the new people of Israel. John the Baptist personifies himself, both faithful Israel and the church, both of which are charged to be this light, to be servants who illumine not ourselves, but rather God. So we celebrate the birth of John the Baptist also as the summer, at the summer solstice, when the sun is at its highest point in the sky. Christmas, on the other hand, is right near the winter solstice, when the sun is its lowest. In a certain sense, that's rather odd. But John is the great bright beacon who points to the light of Jesus. And in the wintertime, at least liturgically, Jesus will emerge to brighten the winter darkness. John's role over these coming months will decrease, and Jesus' role will increase from the time of his birth. You might say that John is like a finger pointing to something like a full moon. And we don't want to confuse the guy who's pointing with what he is pointing to, which is where you and I fit into all this. John is a role model for you and me. You and I are called to, if you will, get rid of the different kinds of, you could even say addictions we may have in pleasing ourselves. We are always called to point to Christ, to ourselves be lights, to be beacons for Jesus Christ, to help cast the light on him, certainly not on ourselves, cast the light on him as the source of all goodness and certainly as the source of all meaning in our lives. So center stage is never the place for you and me. I'd like to, in this context, say a few words about our Fortnight for Freedom, which is the two-week period of teaching, witness, and prayer focused on threats to religious liberty in our country, which began this past Thursday on the eve of our commemoration of the martyrdom of St. John Fisher and St. Thomas More. St. Thomas More was a Catholic statesman. St. John Fisher was a Catholic bishop, who were both murdered at the hands of King Henry VIII, the king who had resolved to take control of the Catholic Church in England. St. John Fisher is often lost in the shadow of St. Thomas More, because maybe in our own times because of the great film, A Man for All Seasons. But one of the things we have to remember about St. John Fisher, it says something about ourselves also, is that he actually was the only bishop in the whole of the church in England who, under persecution, remained loyal to the Holy Father. Only St. John Fisher. We don't want to point fingers, but we know that any of us possibly would not stand up to persecution. Unfortunately, religious liberty is now an urgent matter of concern in the United States. And I will draw on 5 points made just a few days ago by Archbishop Chaput for all of us to remember. So these are his 5 points. First, religious liberty, religious freedom, is a cornerstone of our American experience. Nearly all of the founders of the United States saw religious faith as vital to the life of a free people. Our founders knew that in a republic, virtue is intimately related to religion. They had no doubt that religion is an essential part of the social order because it is a vital part of the moral order. Second point, freedom of religion is far more than only freedom of worship. Our Christian faith certainly begins in worship, our giving of praise and thanksgiving to God, receiving the Eucharist here at Mass. But our faith also demands preaching, teaching, and service. Our faith is always personal, but our faith is never private. The founders of our country created a nation designed to depend on the moral convictions of religious believers and to welcome their active role in public life. Third point, threats against religious freedom in the United States are not imaginary. Father Parker and I have actually been told that threats against religion in America are just imaginary, actually just an invention of our Catholic bishops. But guess what, brothers and sisters? The threats to our religious freedom are immediate, serious, and real. Happily, and this is just a recent instance, very recently, advocates for religious liberty won an important U.S. Supreme Court victory involving a Lutheran church and a Lutheran school. But on the other hand, what is quite disturbing in this particular case involving the Lutherans was the total disregard for religious freedom shown by our government in arguing against them. In that regard, please check out an insert we have in our parish bulletin this week on our government's harassment of U.S. military chaplains and how moral teaching and religious belief can end up being labeled by our government as hate speech. Of course, our present government in Washington opposes meaningful conscience protections for our Catholic and other military chaplains who obviously, for example, cannot in good conscience support so-called same-sex marriage, no matter what orders the government may issue. I just happened to see yesterday on the internet also a story of a group of members of Congress, 66 U.S. representatives, wrote the Secretary of Defense to complain about the anti-religious culture developing in the Air Force. But anyway, that's available to you on the internet. Fourth point, unless we people of faith work hard to protect our religious liberty in the United States, we will lose it. Loss of religious liberty is already advancing across Europe and in Canada. In the end, our U.S. Constitution is merely a piece of worthless paper unless we, our courts, our elected representatives, and of course our president, are all willing to defend our Constitution. Final point. While politics, elections, court decisions, and so on are very important, our religious freedom ultimately depends on us. It depends on our own zeal in living and witnessing to our Christian faith. Religious liberty is an empty shell if the spiritual core of the people is weak. To be blunt, if people don't believe in God, if they don't behave as if they believe in God, they will not value religious liberty, and they will not even want to hear about threats to religious liberty. And that is the heart of the matter. The worst enemies of religious freedom aren't somewhere out there in Washington or somewhere else. The worst enemies of religious freedom are the nominal fake Christians. Some of them may even turn up at churches on Sunday, who just don't care, who are apathetic, and who are ultimately responsible for the threats in our nation today. Some Christians reinvent their own versions of Christianity, essentially dump traditional morality, sometimes piece by piece. They won't take on the whole thing, but here and there they'll say no to what the church teaches. They do not believe. They are disconnected from the reality of God and from the reality of divine law. They don't want to hear anything about threats to religious liberty. All that said, there is, of course, plenty of blame to go around to account for the state of affairs. And again, I'd like to turn the focus on those who call themselves Christian. Probably no one in the church is totally free of blame. But you and I cannot live in a fantasy world of illusion and simply pretend or ignore the fact that we are in deep trouble. Brothers and sisters, if we, all of us, do not now fight vigorously for our religious liberty in the United States, we will lose it. You will wake up one morning and it will be gone. Some of us likely will be in prison. This all probably will not happen overnight. But step by step, as people don't want to be bothered by what is happening. Pope Benedict has reminded us that resistance is part of the task of the church, but it is not your or my mission to ensure that truth triumphs. You and I are, in a certain sense, like St. John the Baptist. We are called to testify and to witness to the truth. We're to open our hearts to God's will, not our own will. We're to love both our country and our church. And we're to renew the witness of the church with the zeal and purity and obedience of our own lives, especially. That is a freedom and joy that no one will ever be able to take away from us.